Welcome to The Vinyl Exam. I'm your host, Keith, and this is episode 164. Last episode, episode 163, we played a mix from a DJ by the name of Tripmaster Monk. It was some excellent Japanese funk and all kinds of sick breaks and incredible good stuff on there. This episode, we're going to sit down and talk to him. So he not only has done some killer mixes, but he's also made some very cool productions of his own. So we'll be sprinkling those in. And Paul and I ended up having a really good conversation about production, records, all kinds of good stuff. So without further ado, let's do it.
Tripmaster Monk, DJ slash producer slash monk, I guess. I go by monk because I'm kind of a hermit. I'm a bit of a recluse. I just spend my free time in my music, pretty much. But yeah, I mean, I started as a DJ. I started DJing in like 97. So.
Wow. So 20 years, man. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it started out as just a scratch DJ in bedroom, you know. Actually, I'm still a bedroom DJ. But yeah, so it started out just scratching. I had one turntable when I first started out. And then eventually evolved into, you know, producing. I bought myself an old Emacs sampler. It's like a SP-12 sampling engine in a synthesizer form. Amazing piece of gear.
That's a pretty cool piece. I've never actually heard of that. So that's circa 1998, 99, right?
So it's like 26 seconds of sampling time, no quantization. It's just, it's got analog filters, but it's an amazing, yeah. I mean, it's very limited as far as what you can do. I mean, when you make an edit, you got to wait like 30 seconds for the processor to actually like complete the edit. So it's very tedious. But yeah, I mean, but the sound is just like to die for.
That's awesome.
That old school low bit, I mean, that low 12 bit, really nice. The Emacs doesn't really have as much of that punch, but it has more of a warmth, and I mean, it has a really nice low end, but
I feel the same way. I mean, it's funny because you're talking about something that where you had to sit there and wait for it to process, and that brought back memories. I actually don't have it in my studio anymore, but I have it upstairs. I have a Roland VS840EX, right? So an 8-track that ran on Zip 250s. And for whatever reason, I really like the sound I get out of it still. I mean, zip discs are impossible to find, so I end up just, you know, I mean, you can find them somewhere. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, part of it is I have old material of ours that's always on that media, so I'm real reluctant to get rid of it for $80, which is what it's worth on the secondary market right now. But yeah, sometimes, I mean, I don't even think there's anything inherent about a Roland that's amazing, but I like the sound I get out of this piece. Something, you know, there's a couple circuits in there that I want to keep in my life.
Something, there's a certain magic about older gear. A lot of the limitations at the time are like what we look back at now and like appreciate, and actually kind of, it's so weird how we want to go back to these old quirks, you know, that we had that were like limitations at the time, but now we look at it as like, oh no, we want that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just an ironic thing. Do a lot of recording. I worked at a couple studios doing recording engineering stuff, and so weird, like whenever I talk to older engineers, like us younger guys, we love that analog, right? We're always talking about, oh yeah, you know, take it to tape, I love tape. And the older engineers, they're like, fuck tape, you know, I'm over that, like give me digital, you know what I mean?
Exactly, because they remember the hours and hours of just needless work they had to do because of working with tape, right?
Yes, absolutely.
That's and crazy.
Young kids were so not familiar with like how, like, you know, having to align these machines and, you know, calibrate it and all the headache that comes with it.
Yeah.
I just love the sound, but, you know, they're like so over it. It's like, it's so weird. I always thought that was funny.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You could even argue that it's like a bragging point now that somebody's like, dude, I spent an hour and a half just trying to set up my tape machine, you know?
Same thing with vinyl now, you know, especially with the whole, I don't know if you saw that news with Shure announcing that they're no longer going to be producing their needles. They're discontinuing their stylus line.
No, I did not see that.
Yeah, they just I think earlier this week they put out a press release or whatever, saying that they're going to discontinue their needle line. And it's kind of a sad moment, you know what I mean? Like, everybody, you know, at least in my circle of DJ friends, we all panicked. You know, everybody went out and tried to, like, stock up on M44-7s. Those are just, like, you know, for DJs, that's the needle, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Panic buy. Yeah, you're cornering the market. Yeah, exactly.
They're already gouging prices now. For a pair of cartridges, it's like over 200 bucks now.
Oh, wow.
And that triggered a whole different debate, like, within the DJ community about, like, you know, sure, you know, they're people were blaming the digital kit, you know, all the new technology. Like, it's because of this new technology that, you know, old, you know, like they were just mad that Shure had to go out of business because of, like, you know, changes in society, you know what I mean?
And yeah.
That was kind of silly to get mad at that, but
it feels like that's weird if there's that devoted. I mean, I guess that's the point, right? One person can't keep any one business in business, but it does feel like if there's enough of a subculture there that it would still stay around. But, you know, big businesses keep on getting bought and changed hands and all that stuff. I mean, I dabble in a couple different genres, and for me, the big news of the week, which I somehow didn't, I don't DJ, so that's why the Shure thing wouldn't hit me too hard, but that Gibson announced bankruptcy. The maker of a lot of really, you know, seminal kind of big time guitars, you know, so no, same thing. People like, you know, I'm reading an article on Reverb, like, what does this mean for my Gibson gear? Will it be harder to find? Blah, blah, blah. So we'll all see where that ends up.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, society is changing so fast. Like, guitars, like, yeah, the fact that guitar businesses are struggling too, it's crazy, man. Like, these are all staple, you know, instruments from, you know, our youth. They're, like, slowly becoming obsolete, like, before our eyes.
Yeah, well, okay, so let me take that, because now I'm having a thought that's intriguing me. If people are buying less DJ cartridges from a standard cartridge maker, right, and if one of the top, let's go with 2-3 brands that makes guitars is declaring, you know, restructuring bankruptcy or whatever, what are people doing? If people aren't doing these things, then what do you think they're doing?
Controllers, MIDI controllers, and, you know, everything's in the box now, and computer-based software, digital audio, you know, workstations. And it seems like, you know, especially with the whole EDM, the rise of EDM, you know, there's like, now everybody can be a DJ, everybody can be a producer technically.
Yeah.
And all you need is just, like, you know, a controller, a MIDI controller, where there's, like, a keyboard form or drum pads, and or both, you know what I mean? There's a lot of companies that have been putting out just MIDI controllers. It seems like that seems to be the new instrument, or it's definitely a new direction as far as making music. There's this subculture, I guess, controllerism. I don't know if that's, like, the best term for it, but
that's a great word. I don't care. I don't care what the best term is.
Just like finger drumming, you know what I mean? Like, being able to just use pads and just create a whole piece of music, just, you know, with samples or, you know, whatever, just soft synths, whatever.
Yeah.
That seems to be the direction that I feel like this.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense, because I can think of two in particular, you know, for me as an analog person. Two particular things that really jump out that caught my attention. I think one was, I'm a sports fan, and there was a commercial for Cam Newton, who, if you don't follow, is one of the more popular quarterbacks in the NFL. And it was this dude. So Cam Newton is, like, doing these drills down on the field, and there's a dude doing exactly what you're saying. He's, like, finger drumming, and doing all of those, like, you know, like, trill rolls. And he's doing it on clearly what's, like, an, you know, an MPC 1000 or something like that. Right. And I was like, is this a thing now? Is people, like, pounding on their drum machines live, like, a thing, you know? And then the other thing is, like, on a Facebook feed, I can't remember who does them, but there's somebody who kind of does these instruments, to what your point. It's like little black, like, rubbery keyboards, but I can't think of who does them. And, like, they change with your pressure sensitivity of your hands, you know? So you end up kind of doing exactly what you're saying. And the person who, of course, did the demo clearly knows what they're doing and was creating, like, just this dope, like, postmodern Prince type stuff. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. But I mean, on the other hand, I'm like, and then of course in the comments you see people that, like, you know, you can just do that on a regular keyboard, right?
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, comments is always going to be filled with, like, negativity. It's so frustrating to see it, too. Like, I feel so bad for content creators that get to put up with that.
You're kind of talking to a collision, right? A collision of how someone is making music and how music does get made these days. I mean, I don't know about you. But for me, you know, like I rely on a lot of things in terms of producing my own music. You know, I can't hire an orchestra. So I buy some samples, or I buy, whatever the orchestral type software is, where I can create these like dope sounding, you know, dark horror type movie sounds. And it's like, on one hand, I feel like I'm cheating. You know what I mean? Like maybe I should go out and feel like I need to hire an orchestra or something. But on the other hand, I'm like, no, this is what making music is today. But on the other hand, it's that guilt that always drives me to be like, okay, well, anybody can just go buy this. So what am I going to do that's going to make this music unique and different and have a level of playing or craft to it that I can use that as a part of it, but not just simply spit out what's there and arrange it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like that's one thing that I've always struggled with myself too. I mean, you look at, like as a vinyl collector, right? I'm sure you can somewhat agree with this, that I feel like music, as far as on a production level, in terms of recording technique and the sonic wise, like I feel like it's kind of regressed. I feel like in the early 70s, maybe late 60s, early 70s, the art of recording kind of like peaked out and it was like wonderful. There's like an apex of it. And then I don't know if it was just the rise of disco or if it was just the concept of like new, you know, electronic sounds and just synthesizers or whatnot, where like we're no longer having to mic instruments. You're just plugging direct into the board. I don't know.
Absolutely.
That, you know, but there was something that occurred where the art of capturing air kind of was no longer, you're no longer seeing that as much in recorded music. Went all out. They're just like, forget mics, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
We'll just use the mic for the vocals and that's it.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to record drums, but we're going to go direct in, and then I'm just going to add layers of electronic reverb to it, and it's going to sound killer, you know. And like, I'm sure just like me, you go back and it's like, I mean, I like a lot of pop music from the 80s, but my God, the recording techniques or just the sound of everything just makes me want to punch a wall sometimes, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Like, I was born in 1980, so
okay.
I grew up with that stuff. You know, I grew up listening to 80s music, and you know, it was whatever. It was good for what it was. But then when I, you know, as I got older and started DJing, started going back in time and started listening to the stuff from the 60s and 70s, and it was like, holy shit, there was a certain magic about these recordings that was not, you know, no longer being captured, and I always wondered why that was. And as I learned more in my craft in art of recording, I realized like, holy shit, man, this is like a dying art form, you know, just something as simple as capturing a room, the way drums were mic'd back in the day, they were using like overheads or room mics, and everything wasn't close mic like it is today, you know what I mean? Now the technique is like, you just stick a different microphone on every, you know, right next to each instrument, or right next to each part of the drum kit, and so it's like, I don't know, it's a different sound, you know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely. No, I totally get it, because the band I'm in, we've recorded albums both ways. You know, we have music out there that was recorded with three mics, and that's it. Like the drums, I mean. The drums were recorded with three mics, right? And there's other music that we've done where the drums were recorded with three mics, and then everybody played live in the room at the same time, too, you know? But then you have other stuff where we just overdubbed our instruments except for drums, and the drums were caught with, I mean, I'm just going to round up to here to about 25 mics, right? And it's like, I mean, you can make both work, but it is interesting to kind of play with the difference. But in both cases too, something you're saying, like you just phrased it wonderfully, having things go through air, no matter what I do in terms of recording something and producing something, it does not feel complete until I send something through air, right? Whatever it's going to be. And you know, like I have tons of guitar modulators and things that can put these great in the, you know, in the box, inside the computer effects on stuff, but it doesn't sound the same. It doesn't sound as good until I just stick a mic somewhere and have it go through some air in my room, you know?
Right? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Which result did you like better as far as the way that it sounded?
I think I like the minimal mic sound. I mean, it's tough. We're going for different things, you know. Like, I mean, we'll get to you on this in a second too. But we've evolved a lot just in terms of what we want to do. You know, our idea of making music is, you know, allowing ourselves to kind of age, mature, you know, change ideas, change styles, whatever, and just kind of play with all of it as opposed to stay one particular place. So the stuff that we're currently working on that we used like 25 mics for works much better for 25 mics, right? The stuff that we did before, the 3-mic stuff, is that typical hard, like funk stuff that's basically like a fusion of maybe funk and like Led Zeppelin drums. So you want big ass drums that are just recorded on, you know, you stick a mic somewhere in a room and you're good, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, obviously then the art becomes, but you got to put it in the right 3 places in the room, right? To the inch or to the centimeter, right? To make sure that you get that right spot. But anyway, I mean, let's talk about you. So you've been, you know, DJing, making music for a long time. What do you think about like your own style over the years?
My own style, I don't know. It's just something I do. I don't really think too much about. I mean, honestly, like I just make music for myself. Mm-hmm. I make music that I've always wanted to hear myself. Like for the longest time, I would go out and try to find. Like I'm a big guy on melody. I love melody and I love breaks. Like I would rather hear a live drummer play a drum kit than hearing a guy just, you know, playing samples. You know, drum machine drums. It's cool. But hearing just a sequenced drum kit, it's not, it just sounds lifeless to me.
Yeah.
But to hear a drummer, like, actually just put down a sick groove with just, you know what I mean? With just the right amount of swing, there's just a certain character, a certain personality that comes through on a drum break that's just like...
Absolutely. No, I agree. I mean, I was walking around a mall the other day, and there was just a couple-piece band getting set up, and the drummer played, like, 2 bars on his kit, and I was like... Hell yeah.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so like
okay.
my whole production technique is focused on so like those are the 2 principles of like my philosophy is venerate the break, like preserve the drummer, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to chop drums. Like I know that especially in hip hop, and what I'm saying is kind of blasphemous in as far as my genre, because within hip hop circles they're all about chopping, you know what I mean? You want to chop
Absolutely.
Up the sample, and to me it's like that's cool and all, but like who are you producing for? Are you producing for other producers, or are you producing for just regular people who might appreciate music, you know what I mean?
Totally.
I feel like chopping it kind of takes away from I mean, it's cool for what it is, sure, you're being creative and you're creating your own something new out of something else, but I mean, to me as a DJ, I feel like it all comes down to just the listener, you know what I mean? Are they gonna like it? Are they, you know, how appealing is it to just the average Joe? And so to me, I preserve even I consider myself more of a mashup artist than a producer. Like I'll take 4-bar melodies. If it's a beautiful melody and it's like very, you know, moving, you know, it could be anything from a movie soundtrack. It could be an old Korean ballad, you know, something. But if it captures a certain feeling or an emotion that just like takes me somewhere, I'll loop that shit and I'll put a, you know, I'll find the breakbeat, the perfect breakbeat to go with it. And then that's usually like the beginning, the starting point of where like my production.
Thank you.
I've gotten a lot of flack from people in my circle, or you know, they just kind of like, they'll say like, oh man, you got to chop it up, you know, you're just gonna leave it as is. Like, why chop it up? It's perfect as it is. Like,
yeah.
They're like, well, you didn't do anything to it. I'm like, I don't care. Like, I didn't have to do anything. The music was beautiful. I'm just like presenting it in a new, I'm just representing it in a new format. You know, maybe just adding some edgy, funky drums behind it. But like, goddamn, like that. Like, is your head not nodding right now? Like,
yeah. Exactly.
You know, and don't get me wrong, I do produce stuff. I top stuff up too. But I just found that like a lot of my favorite beats within even just hip hop, like what I thought was just great production was just really just great ear for, you know, they're taking, like, for instance, get like Dre and Nothing But a G Thing. The sample, it's just, he didn't really do anything to that sample. It was just, he added maybe some drums to it.
Yep.
Just pretty much angled out in a whole list of like all my favorite beats. They were not really produced. They were just loops, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice drum break behind it. And that doesn't take away anything from the producer. I mean, not to say that he didn't really like do anything to it, but I mean, it's still just the ear, just the fact that he's able to bring you something from the past and just like reintroduce it to like a new generation.
Absolutely. I mean, another example that I can think of in the Dre thing that's always moved me, and I may have the sample source wrong, but I think I'm right here, is on the Eve song with Gwen Stefani, "Let Me Blow Your Mind." I'm pretty sure that's like an Axelrod riff buried somewhere in David Axelrod's catalog, that signature riff that on the, that's high on the guitar. You know what I'm talking about, right? I don't want to sing it, but I mean, that's a great ear, like you're talking about, you know what I mean? Like, you found this little thing and then turned it into a hook and it sounds perfect. I have YouTube to thank for this conversation. I don't know if I even told you this as we were kind of warming up to this, but I was on YouTube just like going through stuff, and your the Japanese mix that you did of all the sick Japanese stuff just showed up in my, like, not even recommended. It was just like, oh, here's some other stuff. And I was like, well, this sounds promising, you know, and I'm sure you know that on YouTube, there's kind of varying levels of quality, right? But then I started listening to it and I was like, holy crap, man, this is fantastic, you know? And I fancy myself as someone who knows a couple things about Japanese superhero stuff. And there was some stuff on there that I never even knew.
Yeah, it's a mashup of, I took the sample and then I added some drums to that.
Of course, it had enough things that, like, I was familiar with, you know, where I was like, okay, yeah, I mean, why would you not use that sick Spider-Man, Spider-Man riff, right? Right. Why would you not hit up the Kamen Rider record for something? All your stuff really has this cool, like, organic, is it just the original, like, is he hiring musicians? Is he doing X, Y, and Z? That was the kind of stuff that went through my head as I was listening to a lot of your tracks that you had on SoundCloud, right?
Yeah. It's just all samples. Most of it is just samples, and it's just, I try to find the most obscure, sources for music. I just try to, you know, spotlight great music internationally that was just forgotten or, you know, just not very well known. I mean, Japanese stuff, I love old Japanese stuff. A lot of my stuff is, I say like a good like 30-40% of the samples came from either Japan or Korea.
Wow. How did you get into music from Japan and Korea?
It's weird. Like, you know, growing up, I had listen up, you know, we all listen to our parents' stuff, right? So, like, my parents had a few, like, you know, cassettes and stuff that was just, like, old-school Korean ballad. Really, like, just kind of sappy stuff. But, like, for some reason, it triggered, if it's genetic or something, but it's just something within me. I was like, wow, this is, like, it's so beautiful. It's so sad. And mm-hmm. It's so beautiful. And I always wondered, like, why do I equate beauty with sadness when, as far as music? I never understood that. But always something that stuck with me. It made a lasting impression. And, you know, when as I got older and discovered other music, I noticed that Japanese music is very similar in terms of the style, the whole Enka and the old school, you know, the old ballad. Apparently it was a Korean style, and I guess Japan also kind of adopted it. Because, you know, I don't know if you're familiar, but Japan annexed Korea back in, like, the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Korea was ruled by Japan, so there's a lot of cultural, you know, crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's why, like, the Japanese, when I heard the Japanese stuff, I'm like, oh, that's you know, they're doing exactly the sound that, you know, that I'm into.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and they were doing it on a whole, as far as like, on a sonic level, it was much superior. Like when you listen to old Korean records, it still has a very lo-fi, amateurish recording, you know, element to it. But when you listen to the Japanese stuff, man, like,
yeah, it's pretty sick. Yeah. I mean, again, as a fan of all these, let's go with early to mid 70s. That's when the great stuff was recorded to me. Just like we're talking about. I mean, just the how tight that sound is and how rich that sound is. It's like, oh my. Back in one of the early issues of Wax Poetics, there was something that stuck with me. It was this article on, it was called like the butter sound. It was an article on the butter sound. And it was talking about, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was talking about why the music from 71 to 75 just generally sounds the best, especially to people that think like you and I. And so it went with a bunch of things in mic technique, but it also talked about the players and the fact that you still had limited budgets. So what people would do is they just rehearse the hell out of their material, go in for a 8-hour session, you know, of which you're probably playing like 3 or 4 max, because you're setting up, you're mixing down, you got to pay for that time too. And everybody just had to be so tight and on point and precise in their playing that had a lot to do with everything too. I mean, again, I think the mics matter, but I think also, you know, I think you're going to spend the amount of time one way or another. You're either going to spend it up front practicing, or you're going to spend it on the back end fixing, right?
I was wondering, like, how much do you think Reaganomics played a factor with just cutting school budgets where kids are no longer learning instruments? You look at, like, when you go digging, you see, I look at records and I see a whole bunch of high school music records where it's like, there's just like the band, right? Like the mm-hmm. high school band class, but they're playing like full out orchestrated, like full on like compositions. And it's like,
hell yeah.
You know, these are like, and it's like, wow. Like school was like this back then. Like, what the hell? Like, I never grew up with that. You know, I never had a school band, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Our band was like, maybe in high school we had the football players, you know, with the football band, but that was it. There was no, like, and especially, like, before that, you know, there was no music in our curriculum, you know what I
mean? Yeah, absolutely. And to think about those records, I can't think of a single record that had a 1980 on it to begin, right? A lot of them are 75, 74, maybe 78, 79, but in general, it's all in the 70s, right?
Yeah, yeah. What happened? And then, you know, you read about like Reagan, how he, like, you know, pretty much like gutted the budget for any type of like education, and like the music was like the first thing to go, I think, right? Like,
yeah,
as far mm-hmm. as like budget cuts and stuff. So like, yeah, like it makes me wonder, like, is, you know, how much of that, like how many players do you know that are even like union or session players for anything? You know, it's very rare that you encounter, like, it seems like musicians are a dying breed. I mean, our generation has quite a few, don't get me wrong, but I mean, like, younger than us, like, as far as the kids growing up right now, like,
yeah,
it's like, you know, they're all,
No, I'm totally in line with you. I'm gonna switch genres entirely and talk about thrash metal, because one of the noted icons of thrash metal is a guy named Dave Mustaine. If you know Megadeth, then this is easy for everyone. But he has lamented publicly for like 5 years about the lost art of playing. Right, that people are just kind of riffing out and making metal, but nobody really knows how to play anymore. And you hear that. That's a, you know, I'm thinking of him as I'm talking about it, but plenty of people make that similar comment.
Such a drastic change in the sound.
That as things get more electronic and computery, there's more people that are out there wanting to play electronic computer stuff. And if you don't, if you grow up and you see a kid playing a trumpet well, then you might want to play a trumpet well, you know. But if you grow up and you see people just making beats on samplers, and, you know, all the cool commercials and all the cool people out there seem to be banging away on drum pads, then I feel like there's an influence factor too.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, and I guess technology making things easier too kind of makes, by making the job easier for the human, it kind of reduces the demand or the skill capacity of the person to, like, you know, do what used to be something that was difficult. It was, you know, it's now so easy to be easily done on a computer.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that might be like causing a decline in as far as human skill sets.
I think
so. Look at the smartphone, right? Smartphone has been really you know, how many people actually memorize phone numbers anymore? You know what I mean?
That's a good point. Yeah. Well, and I would even say, you know, this is a thought that's been kicking around in my head for a bit. As someone who, you know, so as someone who's dabbling in metal, as I've hinted at, you know, there's, and even rock, just rock guitar, right? There's this idea of tone, right? Of that's an excellent tone. You hunt for tone. You do this, you do that. But I'm going to universalize that a little bit more. You know, you already kind of hinted about it with the sound to tape, the analog feel, the, you know, I'm going to buy a piece of gear that was last used in 1968. And that's going to, you know, make everything sound great. You know, all this stuff, right? I think as a larger concept, I wonder out loud if it's kind of like, I'm going to solve your problems through sound, which means I'm going to solve your problems through better gear, as opposed to solving your problems through better playing. Elimination of like the expert factor. You know, if you wanted to record a good sounding guitar track in 1975, you would go to a studio. That was your only choice, right? If you want to record a good sounding guitar track in 2018, you can go buy the gear. You can do tons of online tutorials. You can, like you said, just use your own free time to your advantage and knock out, you know, you can knock out an album in your spare time over a year and a half instead of practicing for 6 months and then having 2 days of recording time, right? So you have all those luxuries, but information is probably a huge factor too, because there were expert centers or whatever you want to call them way back in the day. And now those people have been digitized and are online. And of course, the smart ones are making you pay for that expertise, because there's all these great classes you can take, all these great tutorial videos and things like that for the people that are, you know, are good learners. That
it blows my mind how many like kids like are like so good at something right now, and it's like they just picked it up just from watching YouTube tutorials.
Yeah.
It's like stuff that took, you know, years to perfect and to get it to where it was for the people before that. Now it's like technology is kind of even the playing field to where, you know, it's crazy, because, you know, it's a cycle. I feel like there's always going to be that older generation who hates on what the kids are doing. And that, you know, I'm sure it has a lot to do with the fact that, like, something that took a guy 20 years to, like, master these techniques and, you know, these figure out how to do, they, you know, somebody puts it up on YouTube and now kids can just instantaneously just download that knowledge, that skill set, and just, like, execute it like that. I mean, even with turntablism, with scratching, you see that happen, like, all the time. Like, as technology progresses, where now you have like a Serato, right? Where you don't even need records anymore. You just have two records that has your control record, and now you can control your whole digital library. That, like, I remember, you know, that was met with a lot of resistance when it first came out.
Yeah.
Especially within hip hop. Like, hip hop tends to be a very conservative. There's this, like, it's always a throwback to like better times in the past, right? Like,
yeah.
Especially in hip hop, the keep it real mentality is very prevalent.
Sure.
And that's a whole different conversation. I don't even know if I want to open that can of worms, but yeah, like there's this, you know, there's a sense of like just, you know, refusing change. I feel like that's kind of what killed hip hop too. Just this refusal to get with the times or to embrace any type of new, anything new is always met with resistance for some reason. I don't know why that is, But yeah, I feel like that's why the genre, it felt kind of stagnated, or it kind of, I don't know, maybe, I don't know if it stagnated, but I feel like it was no longer keeping up with the taste of, you know, what people were wanting. And so, like, I feel like kids, like, you listen to younger kids, I don't know if you're familiar with how everybody, like, hates on this, the new generation of rap, like, they call it mumble rap or
whatever. Yeah, yeah. I do personally hate on it, although every now and then I'll hear a song where I'm like, okay, this is kind of cool. I like it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's not for me. I mean, I'll admit, it's not for me. You know, it's definitely something the kids, you know, it's their sound. And, like, I, for the longest time, I was, you know, I caught myself being that guy, you know, that old, you know, hating on what the young kids were listening to. And I realized, dude, I sound exactly like, you know, like my parents, you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. Why are you listening to that hippity-hoppity, right?
Yeah, you know, it's like the same stuff that they're saying about, like, my gangster rap and stuff that I was growing up listening to, like, that fueled, actually made me like it even more, just the fact that they
absolutely
were so, like, adamantly.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, no, I go on rants to my kids. I'm like, I mean, a song will come on and I'll just be like, yo, real talk here? This shit sucks. Like, it's just objectively bad on every level. I have no idea why you like it, you know?
Yeah, I agree. But you know, I've come to this, like, I don't have kids, but when I do, I've thought about this, like, what am I? Because I don't want my kids listening to that stuff. I don't want them listening to, like, you know, Molly Percocet and just, like, a lot of the stuff is just garbage. The content, right? Like, it's really not good for the kids to be listening to this stuff. But they were saying the same thing about my gangster rap. You know, I'm sure they felt exactly the same.
I know.
I mean, especially more so even back then, because, like, it was such a, the shock value was still there.
Oh, hell yes.
And it was like, you know, glorifying crime and stuff in.
Or even darker stuff like the Ghetto Boys, right? I mean, the Ghetto Boys really pushed the envelope. And then you even had like these little tributaries, right? You had horrorcore, you had all that kind of stuff, right? So yeah, I mean, there was definitely boundary pushing stuff 20, 25 years ago too.
Yeah. So like, I was wondering, like, dude, what am I going to do when I have kids? And I realized, like, dude, what I got to do is I got to be that lame that dad, or that one dad who tries to be like hip with the kids still, who tries to be like cool, so like they try to, like, you know, listen to what the kids are listening to, and like I'm gonna embarrass the shit out of my kid. I'll be like, look, I'm gonna go pick him up from school and, you know, be bumping Migos and just embarrass the shit out of him, make him like, dad, like, stop, you know, like, just make him not want to have anything to do with his dad's music.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll be bumping that. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna totally, like, mind fuck him and make him, like, not want to have anything to do with it.
You know what? Screw you, Dad. I'm going to go do my own thing. I'm going to go listen to Wu-Tang Clan. Take that.
Exactly. And I think it's, I don't know. I think it'll work, because kids are naturally going to be inclined to rebel. And anything that your dad listens to is, at least when you're young, it's automatically considered lame. You know what I mean?
Makes sense.
They're not going to have anything. They don't want anything to do with it. So weird.
Yeah.
But I'm that's just, yeah, I don't know. I just thought of that the other day. I'm like, yeah, I'm totally going to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah, so I started DJing '97, bought a set of, two Techniques 1200s and a Vestec mixer with a buddy of mine. We both saved up from, like, a summer school job, and then we split the cost of two turntables, and then we started DJing, and at first it was, like, hip-hop, underground hip-hop and stuff like that, and then, you know, we split up, went to college, we each took our turntable each, and then we kind of just went off and did our own thing. For the longest time, I only had, you know, one turntable. And practicing scratching kind of sucks when you don't have another turntable to play music. So, you know, that's when I picked up the sampler and I was like, forget it, I'm going to start, you know, making my own beats to scratch too and stuff like that. So from there, then it was just, you know, finding samples now. And, like, now I got this gear, now I got to make music. And the piece of gear that I bought, the Emax, doesn't come with any sounds on it. It's just a pure sampler. So it was up to me to figure out, like, oh, great, I bought something that doesn't have any, like, there's no sounds for me to play on here. So it's like, okay, I guess I got to find my own sound.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, not even a starter kit of sounds. You just go.
Yeah, like nothing. Like, are really? Like, you didn't give me anything? So yeah, so I went out and started, that was my quest for digging. Like, I'd say in 99, I started digging for records and just trying to find sounds. And, you know, it was not, you know, and in the beginning, it's tough. Like, you, when you're clueless as to, like, where to find good sounds, you know, you end up buying a lot of garbage records, and then you kind of learn. You start figuring out, you know, okay, stay away from that label, stay away from this. And then, you know, as you progress, you start figuring out, you know, little hints or little, like, signs of a good find. Yeah, so, like, just as years progressed, I just accumulated more vinyl, and then it became an obsession, like, not only for the sake, because as I was looking for samples, that was when I would actually listen to these records and actually appreciate for the first time the music, you know, that was before my time. And that was when it really, that's what really sparked, you know, my passion for vinyl. When I realized, like, dude, this is where it's at. Like, this is like a gold mine of sound as far as just like music-wise and, you know, sonic quality, just technique, musicianship, everything. It was just on a whole new level. And I'm sure psychedelics played a huge role in that as well. And, you know, just there's so many different factors with the times of, you know, it's a reflection of the times. And, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you had, like, I guess, the post World War II, you had, you know, the hippies came, the rise of psychedelics, and then, yeah, there's a whole lot of cultural change, right? A lot of counterculture going on.
Yeah.
And I feel like that fueled this whole, internationally too, it wasn't just the United States. The United States might have been one of the drivers of it, but the whole world kind of embraced this new, at the time, what it was new, this new psychedelic, new sound, right? It was like definitely a new rock, funk fusion of rhythms and sounds that was just like, man, it was a beautiful thing. And so, like, that became like my new obsession, like finding that, you know, that beautiful melody or that one riff or that one lick or that break, that drum break.
Mm-hmm.
That just, it fueled this new passion. And that's kind of like, to this day, that's kind of all I listen to is like old stuff now. It's weird because I'm so out of touch with like what the kids are listening to or what's hip. And I've been in my own world for so long.
That's in my opinion, it's like, I don't know, wondering about what's hip should be the first sign you're doing something wrong.
Right.
Right. I agree. But like at the same time, I've also realized like, dude, I've become so irrelevant. Like I realized like, you know, I'm already like I'm approaching my late 30s now. I'm no longer, you know, I'm now that older, that dad, you know, that guy who's like, I wonder, like, am I that guy now? Am I already like that dad who's trying to be hip by listening to like what the kids are listening to? Because I listen to it and it's like, oh my God, like, what has happened to this genre? And
yeah.
I mean, it's catchy. A lot of stuff is catchy, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I just feel like just keep on going with whatever is going for you. Whatever's working for you, just keep it up. There's other people like that. There's too many damn people in the world to not have a ton of people that think exactly like you think.
Like when you mentioned about that, the video, that Japanese mix, I put that mix up like 2 years ago. And, you know, it was like maybe like up until like 2 months ago, it was like maybe hovering at like maybe 10,000 views. Like
no way.
Very little. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, 2 months ago, it just, I don't know what YouTube did with their algorithm, but I think it started showing up on people's, you know, recommended or to watch feeds. And then like, it just blew up like overnight, like not overnight, but like within, you know, the past 2 months, it's already like, I think it's approaching like 300,000 views, which just blows my mind because for the first 2 years, it was barely like, you know, it's so weird. I don't know how that happened, but
that's crazy.
Definitely some algorithm at work that I have to thank for that. But yeah, it's just like, I'm just like overwhelmed now. Like my email just flooded with like new subscribers and new comments. It's like, what's going on here? It's like out of nowhere. And so, I mean, it's definitely cool. It's definitely nice to like, you know, get some traffic that way. But yeah, it's just, I have no idea what happened.
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild that it just kind of, I don't want to say overnight, but pretty close for it to go from 10,000 views maybe 3 months ago to, you know, pushing 400K now. I kind of think it was 350 or 360 when I listened to it, you know, about a week ago, something like that.
Oh, shit, really? Yeah. yeah, it's been a while since I checked, but yeah, it's crazy, man. It's nice that, like, a lot of people, I didn't think that, you know, that many people were into it, but now I'm realizing, dude, there's a lot of people that do appreciate it.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool. So what are you working on now? I mean, you have other stuff and you're working on tracks and things. What else you got cooking?
I'm thinking about doing a volume, like a second follow-up, another Japanese mix, because I have a whole bunch of, too much Japanese stuff.
Mm.
Like, that's just like really good stuff too that like, you know, I kind of hoard it too. Like I just have like this archive of just great music that I haven't really done anything with and haven't really... So it's like, yeah, maybe I should do a follow-up. I don't know. I'm debating whether or not.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a little bit of a different influence when 10,000 people have listened to it versus 350,000, right?
Yeah, it definitely played a role. It's weird. Like, I'm so torn too because, you notice that I didn't put up a track list for that mm-hmm. mix, and I'm getting a lot of like flack for that. A lot of heat or a lot of, you know, angry comments. They're like, you know, what the fuck, you know, there's no, you know, people are like saying like, it's a crime. Very protective of their copyright. So I was hesitant to put up a track list.
Cause sure.
By doing so, you're kind of notifying them of, hey, you know, I'm
absolutely. Yeah. You're asking, you're theoretically asking for trouble. You may never get found out, but you're definitely asking for trouble.
Yeah. Like and then there's so much content I've seen on YouTube where like, just like somebody posted a kaiju video or just like, a random picture of a random little video of like some old, you know, Ultraman or Kikaida Man or whatever. There's so many different things and it just gets taken down like for no reason other than the fact that the guy, you know, the copyright holder just didn't want to see. I don't know. It's so weird because like YouTube is such a great tool for promoting, you know, forgotten things. And I would think that like they would love the exposure, but I guess, you know, I don't know if it may be a cultural thing.
Yeah, could be. I mean, it's probably an ownership thing. I mean, you mentioned kaiju, which makes me think that we need to have another conversation entirely because I'm a massive kaiju fan.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw your on your. I was looking at the different past episodes, and I saw like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, huge in kaiju, and most people who own these properties are beyond protective about it. That's just it's their property and they come after you much harder than anybody else is going to. You know, I mean, there's almost kind of like I don't want to say a Mount Rushmore, but maybe kind of a top 10 of people that you just don't want to mess with because they spend a lot of time scouring for violations. You know, Toho, who owns Godzilla, is one of them.
Dude, the Toho is scary how much they enforce their. So you're a Godzilla head.
Big time. Yeah.
OK, so you're into the soundtracks, too?
Absolutely.
So okay, why does Riichiro Manabe get so hated on within Godzilla soundtrack circles? Like,
are you talking about Smog Monster and Megalon? Yeah. I don't know why. I think because they're different, right? I mean, those are two of my favorites. So they're the two funkiest by far. They don't have your typical big, you know, Ifukube booming orchestration to signify the monster's arrival. In Smog Monster's case, the music's corny. You know what I mean? Like those horn refrains that kind of come up and, you know, they fit the craziness and to me, wonderful strangeness of the movie. And, you know, people just hate Megalon like they hate Jar Jar Binks. You know, Megalon was made at a time when the music and the movie industry was just dying and they had no money. Smog Monster's now been reissued once, if not twice, by... I can't remember the guy's name, but it's through Holy Mountain Printing. There are vinyl soundtracks of those, and they just press up very, very tiny amounts, and they sell out immediately.
that composer is one of my favorite composers just overall, aside from the Godzilla stuff, but like his other soundtracks too are amazing.
Interesting. I'm not familiar with his other work. I just have a Godzilla-centric view on things. What is his other stuff that you like?
Crest of the Wolf. There's a soundtrack called Crest of the Wolf. That one's amazing too. I don't know if you're into like the Japanese horror stuff, but he did like Dracula stuff. He has a couple of things that were really good. That were like a lot of stuff that was on that mix. I don't know if you're familiar with. You know, I don't even know what the track was called. It was off of a compilation that I had.
Okay.
But yeah, somebody asked about it, and I sent them a link for it. Instead of posting the track list, what I do is when somebody asks about it, I just post.
Yeah, you'll answer direct questions, but you won't post a track list. Okay. No, that's interesting. I feel like I'm kind of familiar with it just from some other record collectors I know who aren't as deep, perhaps, in the genre as you might be, but they definitely know what the dope records are, and they found their way into a lot of those records.
I did dig deep, but you know, a lot of the stuff I feel like was well known, like the Spider-Man stuff, and a lot of stuff was familiar, right? Like a lot of the.
I'd go with 40, 50% of it was for me.
So a lot of those songs I used were stuff that I had sampled in the past, or stuff that you know I was planning on sampling. So like I was very like, you know, I'm still kind of old school mentality where you know we cover our labels so that you don't let other people like peek over your shoulder while you're DJing and see what you're spinning.
I have this theory that 90% of the people that ask you about your stuff are DJs or producers themselves. And so odds are, you know, I don't think it's wrong to think that you should, you know, like they're asking you for that track list because they want to make a track out of it most likely. You know, I mean, in my case, I tend to ask for track lists because I want the record. I just want the record. That's the collector mentality and I suppose the collector problem in a lot of ways. But also it's because, yeah, in my particular case, like I've been making music for 25 years. And, you know, when you're a breakbeat junkie, and you also are in a band and you can make your own beats. Like I have more beats saved on my computer than I can ever use to make music with for the rest of my life. So I don't need to buy anything. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't mean I don't want to buy stuff and I'm going to refrain from buying a break, but I definitely don't have a motive of I'm going to turn this into a track when I hear stuff. And maybe that's just good old fashioned paranoia that dates back to, you know, DJs that switched their labels in the Bronx in 1977.
You know? I don't know what it is. Like I kind of question that myself. Like, why am I being so like protective of this stuff? Like, am I like still trapped in like an old mentality? Because like it seems like the new mentality is as far as like Web 2.0 is content, right? Sharing everything.
Yeah.
It's this whole share mentality, and I feel like that's progressed a lot of. You know, you're definitely helping progress a lot of things as far as like you know in terms of like movement in society or whatever by openly sharing. I feel like that's a good thing, right? Like,
yeah.
So I'm like, I'm questioning, like, maybe I should just post the track list, not care. But then again, like, you know, what you said, you touched on, you know, a lot of the people who are asking are probably just other producers. You just want to.
Yeah.
If people want to hear the music, I'll definitely put it out there. But I always felt like, you know, I always questioned whether the demand was there.
Yeah.
Because I'm just in my own little world of making music just from, like, to make my own head nod. I always question, like, will other people also, like, dig this the way I dig this? I really don't know.
Yeah. So, well, the answer is yes. The answer is yes.
Really? I mean, you heard this stuff. What did you think? I mean,
dude, I think your stuff's dope. I mean, I think it's great. Again, I think I'm going to get the artist wrong, right? But I really want to say that it's you too. I really want to say it's Bono that said this. And it was something along the lines of, if you make music for yourself, then you need not worry because there are hundreds of thousands of people that are thinking like you. Thanks, as always, for hanging out with me on this episode of The Vinyl Exam. Of course, if you want more Vinyl Exam, you can head on over to our website. That's www.thevinylexam.com. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon. If you haven't checked out our Patreon page, head over there and see what it's all about. On that note, of course, I'd like to thank our official Vinyl Examiners through Patreon, Brian Siebold and Yan Wong, and our executive producers, Janine Cuevas, Austell Gray, and Ben Lack.